Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Job chapter 16. I'll call this chapter Job Responds to Eliphaz. Miserable comforters are you. We are in the midst of Job's dialogue with his three false friends. We've already rolled through Eliphaz, false friend number one, and then Bildad the Shuhite, false friend number two, and then Zophar the Naamathite, false friend number three. Job has answered them all in turn, and now we're starting over again. The first false friend, Eliphaz, has spoken again in the previous chapter. Chapter 15, we entitled Eliphaz Accuses. Job does not fear God. The same old, Job has sinned. He doesn't fear God. If he would just confess his sin, his miseries would be over. And Job responds, look, I haven't sinned, not any more than anybody else in this world, not to justify all this misery that's come upon me. So how do you explain that, my false friends? And so we are going to see a variation on that theme here in chapter 16. When Job replies, he responds to Eliphaz, but he's also responding to the other false friends too. And he says, miserable comforters are you. That's the understatement of the century. We start now in Job 16, verses 1 through 5. Then Job answered, I have heard many things like these. You are all miserable comforters. Is there no end to your empty words? What provokes you that you continue testifying? If you were in my place, I could also talk like you. I could string words together against you and shake my head at you. Instead, I would encourage you with my mouth, and the consolation from my lips would bring relief. Job answers in verse 1. He's answering Eliphaz, because Eliphaz was who spoke in chapter 15, the previous chapter. And Job says, I've heard many things like these. Like what? Well, about God punishing evil people in this life, because that's what Eliphaz spent chapter 15 doing. He kept saying, Job, bad things happen to bad people. And he goes on and on very poetically talking about all the miseries of people who rebel against God. Job doesn't complain about that. He knows that. And so he says here in verse 1, I've heard things like that. I'm not complaining about that. I agree with you, Eliphaz. Where has Job heard many things like Eliphaz has been speaking about how the wicked do not prosper? Well, he's heard. Job has. He's heard from his parents. He's heard from the ancients, ancient wisdom, ancient tradition. And so he says, look, you are all miserable comforters. I know what you're saying is true. You're not helping me any, because you're not explaining why I didn't do anything unjust. I didn't commit any sin, not any more than the average person. Of course, I'm born into original sin like everybody. I'm not perfect, but I haven't done anything egregiously awful in order to justify all this misery that I'm suffering. And so he says, there's no end to your empty words, Eliphaz. You just keep on blathering all this same stupidity. The NASB has your windy words. This, of course, is a retort to Eliphaz, as Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown point out in Job 15:2. Eliphaz says, should a wise man answer with windy knowledge and fill himself with the east wind? Basically saying that Job was a windbag. And so Job answers, you're the windbag, Eliphaz. Is there no end to your windy words? That's the NASB. I like that translation better than the Holman Christian Study Bible, which says empty words, windy words. What provokes you to continue testifying? In other words, NIV says, what ails you that you keep on arguing? Are you sick that you keep talking like you're talking? And then he says in verse 4, if you were in my place, I could also talk like you. So Job reverses the situation and he says, this is what I would do if you were sitting where I am miserable. I could do two things. One, I could string empty words together and shake my head at you. And shaking the head was a sign of derision in the East. I could say, hey, Eliphaz and company, you're a bunch of sinners. That's why you're suffering. But on the other hand, I could do something else. Verse 5, I could encourage you with my mouth. I could give you consolation from my lips. I could bring you relief. But of course, you, Eliphaz, are not doing that for me. I would do it for you, but you're not doing it for me. We go now to Job 16, verses 6 through 9. Job continues, even if I speak, my suffering is not relieved. And if I hold back, what have I lost? Now that makes absolutely no sense. What have I lost? I'll explain that in a minute. Job continues, verse 7, surely he has now exhausted me, meaning God has exhausted me. You, God, have devastated my entire family. You have shriveled me up. It has become a witness. My frailty rises up against me and testifies to my face. His, that's talking about God's anger tears at me, and he harasses me. God harasses me. God gnashes his teeth at me. My enemy. pierces me with his, God's, eyes. My enemy God pierces me with his eyes. Now you can see Job is very upset with God because God is not answering his prayer. Job is saying, I'm caught between the rock and the hard place. In verse 6, I can speak. It doesn't matter. If I try to defend myself, I'm still suffering. And if I hold back, if I don't speak, the NIV says, if I refrain, it does not go away. In other words, my suffering doesn't go away. So if I speak, I still have suffering. If I don't speak, I still have suffering. Now the translations here are kind of problematic, if you ask me. Hard to understand. Holman Christian Study Bible says, if I hold back, what have I lost? Jameson Fawcett Brown says that literally means, what portion of my suffering, what portion of my sufferings goes from me? Well, if that's what it is, the translation doesn't carry it out. That's why I like the NIV translation here. If I refrain, the suffering does not go away. Now, Job says in verse 7 that God has exhausted him. God has devastated his entire family. You recall, 7 sons and 3 daughters were wiped out in chapter 1 with a windstorm, when a windstorm came and blew the house down that they were having a party in. Now, that's not a absolute 100% certain translation. You have devastated my entire family. Actually, the literal is company. NASB has company. You have devastated my company. The NIV says my household. Holman Christian Study Bible has, you have devastated my family. John Gill says that company could mean the believers in God who met at God's, at Job's house to worship. Or it could mean Job's children and his servants, as I just said. Or it could be the company of Job's friends who came to see him in his suffering and who turned away from him, the 3 false friends. But I think it's just as easy to say it's his family. You've devastated my family. You have shriveled me up. The NIV says, refers to Job here in his gauntness. He shriveled him up, and that's literally how he was. Remember, he was covered with boils from head to toe, scraping his boil so that he looked like one big boil. And so Job just mentions that as one more example of how miserable he is. My frailty rises up against me. I'm weak. Nobody pays any attention to weak, sick people. Now, I said that Job is talking to God. You, God, have shriveled me up. And verse 9, your anger, God, tears at me. So, matter of fact, commentators disagree on who that is. I said it was God. Holman Christian Study Bible capitalizes all the pronouns. Of course, they put it at the beginning of a line of poetry, so you can't tell whether the capital letter there refers to God or somebody else. But here he gnashes his teeth. That's a his in the middle of the line with a capital H. My enemy pierces me with his eyes, another capital H in the middle of a line. So the Holman Christian Study Bible takes this as God, who is Job's enemy here. Adam Clark says it's a question on which commentators have greatly differed. Well, who is it? Well, if it's God, as I said it was, as the Holman Christian Study Bible and other translations say it is God, the NIV just flat out translates, God assails me. That fits in with what Job is thinking about God here, because back in Job 10:16, Job says this, should my head be lifted up, you, i.e. God, capital Y, you would hunt me like a lion. And again, you, capital Y, would show your, capital Y, your power against me. But other people have said, no, this is not God angry at Job, this is Eliphaz. Eliphaz's anger tears at me, and Eliphaz harasses me. Eliphaz gnashes his teeth at me. Adam Clark says it's the devil. You have shriveled me up, devil. Well, where does he say he's talking to the devil? He doesn't even mention the devil. That's not even in the context. I believe that the balance of the equities has it that Job is talking about God here, God being angry with him and causing all this trouble. Now, of course, Job is upset with God. Job wrongly thought that God was angry at him. Actually, God was testing him, not punishing him, as the NIV Study Bible puts it. Quote, such subtle distinctions, i.e. the distinction between testing and punishing, such subtle distinctions are hard to sort out while facing severe suffering. However, in the process of refining our faith, God often chooses to keep his purposes hidden. Ain't that the truth? We go now to Job 16, verses 10 through 11. Job continues, they have gaped at me with their mouth. Now, the they is talking about the false friends now. He's turned his attention away from God, and he's now complaining about his so-called friends. They have gaped at me with their mouth. They have slapped me on the cheek with contempt. They have massed themselves against me. God hands me over to ruffians and tosses me into the hands of the wicked. He calls them ruffians. They have gaped at me with their mouth and slapped me on the cheek with contempt. Notice this is not physical pain that his friends are causing Job. This is emotional pain, disrespect, lack of honor, which is a big thing. The big thing to men in general, and especially to these ancient tribal people, they had an honor society. And now Job has lost all of his honor. Now, I don't know if the shame was worse than the physical pain. I saw a sting video in China of a young man who was committing adultery on his wife, and his friends decided to punish him, and so they broke into the room where and caught him in flagrante delicto with his girlfriend and took movies of his, and they didn't touch him, they didn't arrest him, they didn't turn him over to the cops, they just started taking movies. And he's naked, and he slides down by the side of the bed and holds his head in his hands, and for a Chinese person, that was a fate worse than death. Shame. It's something that we in the West cannot fathom. And I don't think we can fathom the shame that Job was feeling. He says, Job does, that they, his false friends, have massed themselves against me. As John Gill says, Job's three friends got together first before they went to see Job. They massed themselves. They got together. And in addition, they probably brought a large retinue of servants with them too. So here Job is miserable. He's scraping his boils. And all of a sudden, here comes the army of accusers, his false friends. Now, verse 11, Job said, God hands me over to ruffians. I said that was referring to his false friends. I think it is referring to his false friends, as Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say. Other people have suggested perhaps it's Satan. God hands me over to ruffians, demons. Nah, Satan's not in the context here. God tosses me into the hands of the wicked. Well, it could refer to the Chaldeans who stole his camels and the Sabaeans who stole his oxes and donkeys. I don't think so. I think Job is referring to his false friends. He's letting them hold it right now. Job 16, verses 12 through 14, Job continues, I was at ease, but he shattered me. The he is capital here in the H in the Holman Christian Study Bible. But he, God, shattered me. God seized me by the scruff of the neck and smashed me to pieces. He set me up as his target. His archers surround me. He pierces my kidneys without mercy and pours my bile on the ground. He breaks through my defenses again and again. He charges at me like a warrior. Boy, have you ever felt like God was against you? Look at Job. Nobody is ever going to top his misery, thinking that God had abandoned him. I think of the other time that someone thought that God had abandoned him. Remember when Jesus said, my God, why have you forsaken me? Oh my gosh. As human beings, there's nothing worse than to feel like God has left you. Verse 12 says, I was at ease, but he shattered me, Job says. The he I said was God, but other people said maybe it's Satan. Some people said maybe it's Job's false friends, because the capital H is not in the original text, of course. But we're going to take it as God, Job says, that God seized me by the scruff of the neck, smashed me to pieces, set me up as his target. His archers surround me. So Job is standing there like a target. He looks down the field there, and there's God's archers pulling their bows back, ready to shoot him. The Septuagint has spears. His spears surround me. Either way, whether it's an arrow or a spear, Job is about to get shot at and pierced. Verse 13, he, God, pierces my kidneys without mercy and pours my bile on the ground. Well, what is bile? According to Wikipedia, bile is a dark green to yellowish brown fluid produced by the liver and stored in the gallbladder. The purpose of bile is to aid in the digestion of lipids in the small intestine. Well, that's something I never knew until yesterday. That stuff is important somehow in one's biology, and it's leaked out on the ground because God's shooting arrows at Job. Verse 14, God breaks through my defenses again and again, like a wall broken down in a military siege. God breaks down another wall. Job is defending himself. He's saying, look, I didn't do anything, God. Bang. Oh, there's another breach in the wall. God's making me miserable again. Job is asking a very logical question. What's going on here, God? We go to Job 16, verses 15 through 17. Job continues, I have sewn sackcloth over my skin. I have buried my strength in the dust. My face has grown red with weeping, and darkness covers my eyes, although my hands are free from violence and my prayer is pure. So yes, Job has put sackcloth on. Looks like he had to sew it or get somebody to sew it for him, because that's what he's wearing now. He's not wearing normal clothes, and sackcloth, of course, is the coarse cloth that's used to make sacks so that you can put seeds in the sack. Coarse black hair. Maybe horsehair that makes it, I don't know, but it's real rough, it's real cheap. And Job was probably not used to wearing sackcloth. He was a wealthy man. And it must have really been bad to wear sackcloth, considering Job's boils, his sores, his broken skin, all of which would have stuck to the sackcloth very painfully. Job says, I've buried my strength in the dust. NIV says, I've buried my brow in the dust. I'm face down. I'm face planted in the dirt, God. The NASB has, I've thrust my horn in the dust, which of course is the typical Old Testament way of saying my strength, because a horn of an animal is its strength. My strength is in the dust. My face has grown red from weeping. That was what happens when you cry all the time. Job never stopped crying. Darkness covers my eyes. Now, that could mean that his eyes were dark and black from crying, or it could be just that his eyes see nothing but darkness. He sees no light. And then Job says in verse 17, although my hands are free from violence and my prayer is pure. Well, Job is refuting Eliphaz's slander that Job didn't pray. In our last chapter, when Eliphaz was bloviating, we read in Job 15:4, Eliphaz is talking to Job, and he says this, indeed, you, Job, do away with reverence and hinder meditation before God, which implies that he's not praying to God. Of course, he could have been saying, Job, when you hinder meditation before God, you keep people from meditating before God because you're justifying unconfessed sin, and other people will do the same thing, and pretty soon they won't be talking to God anymore. But it's at least a broad implication, Eliphaz has given Job in Job 15:4, that Job is not praying. Job says, not only am I praying, my prayer is pure. Now John Gill says of this, quote, he does not say there was no sin in him, nor any sin in his heart, nor in his life, nor any iniquity done by him. He had acknowledged these things before, Job chapter 7, verse 20, but there was nothing in his hands gotten in an unjust manner. He had taken away no man's property, nor injured him in the least in a private way, nor had he perverted justice as a public magistrate by taking bribes or accepting persons, and could challenge any to prove he had. So Job is not saying he is perfect like Adam was before he ate the fruit, but he's saying, compared with the average run-of-the-mill person in this life, he was pure. He hadn't done anything. My hands are free from violence. Of course, Job has been maintaining his innocence all the way through these first 16 chapters. He says, although my hands are free from violence, in verse 17, that's probably an answer to Eliphaz, who said in Job 11, verse 14, if iniquity is in your hand, Job, put it far away, and do not let wickedness dwell in your tents. If iniquity is in your hand, and Job says, my hands are free from violence. We go down to Job 16, verse 18. O earth, do not cover my blood, and let there be no resting place for my cry. Now, this phrase, O earth, do not cover my blood, has given rise to perhaps four different explanations, which I will run through, but all four of these explanations proclaim Job as an innocent man, and that's the main thing we need to grab a hold of. Option number one, what does Job mean when he says, O earth, do not cover my blood? Option number one, this is from John Gill. This is an imprecation against himself. He is, if Job is guilty of crimes. Job says that after his death, his blood will call out for punishment, will call out for punishment to fall on Job's own head, which of course Job doesn't think is going to happen because he thinks he's innocent. He knows he's innocent. He doesn't want the earth to cover his blood because he wants his blood to call out loud and clear, Job is innocent. Now, how about the earth cover up his blood so that people might not know that Job was innocent? Well, it could be licked up by dogs. Job's body would have no burial, no proper burial. And so Job is now saying, O earth, don't cover my blood. In other words, let the earth damn me. Let the blood that's on the earth call out for punishment. My blood call out for punishment if I've done anything wrong, which I haven't. So this would be a self-imprecation that Job brings on himself, but he's not worried about such self-imprecation because he knows he hasn't done anything wrong. So that's option number one. Job is saying, I'm innocent. Adam Clark says option number two, this is a straight-out profession of innocence because Job is asking that the blood of his murdered victims not be covered up. O earth, do not cover my blood that I have shed on the ground from the victims that I've murdered, because Job was absolutely sure there were no murdered victims. So he says, okay, let the blood of my murdered victims, my hypothetical murdered victims, cry out for vengeance. Doesn't matter to me because I'm innocent. I didn't kill anybody. Well, to me, that's a stretch. Do not cover my blood. My blood would have to be the blood that I shed of my murdered victims. That seems to be a stretch. But if it's true, it's still Job proclaiming his innocence. Option number three, the blood is Job's lifeblood calling out for justice against his destroyers. In other words, it's Job's blood, but he's not self-imprecating himself as option number one, but his blood is calling out for justice or for imprecation against those who've attacked Job. It's not self-imprecation, but it's imprecation of Job's destroyers. So Job's blood is his life. His life has been taken unjustly from him. His blood calls for vengeance. And Job asks that this call of vengeance not be stopped by two possibilities. One, the earth covers his blood. Or two, that his cry for vengeance stops, i.e. finds a resting place. Let there be no resting place for my cry in verse 18. In other words, my cry for vengeance. I prefer that option, option number three. Albert Barnes says that the blood that's crying out from the ground is metaphorical. It stands for the wrong done to Job. Job does not want the earth to conceal the crime that's been done to him. So it's not Job's blood, but it's the wrong that's been done to Job. Well, however you take it, Job is saying here loud and clear, Eliphaz, I have not sinned in such a way that I deserve this punishment. You are a miserable comforter. I'll shout it out. My blood will shout it out even after I'm dead. There's not going to be any stopping place for my cry. I'm going to cry out. My cry of distress and innocence will not find a resting place in God's ears. As John Gill puts it, or Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say that Job's cry of innocence would never stop as it goes abroad in the earth, so that Job's innocence would be as well known to man as to God. We go now to Job 16, verses 19 through 21. Even now, Job continues, behold, my witness is in heaven, and my advocate is on high. My friends are my scoffers, my eye weeps to God. Oh, that a man might plead with God as a man with his neighbor. Now, this is a little confusing. In verse 19, Job says, my witness is in heaven. Again, we're talking about a heavenly courtroom here. Job needs a witness. He needs a lawyer, my advocate. Of course, witness and advocate are in parallel with each other, and so we could say the witness is the same thing as the advocate. We're not going to get too technically legal here. But the question is who is this witness? Who is this advocate in God's heavenly courtroom on high? The NIV Study Bible suggests it's Job himself. He says, my witness, in other words, I'm telling you, I'm putting my words up there, God, I've just told you I'm innocent. And so I myself am my own lawyer, and I myself am my own witness. I think that's reasonable. Or maybe Job is asking for some kind of hypothetical heavenly mediator, as the NIV Study Bible suggests. That's reasonable. John Gill, Adam Clark, and Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown all say that it's God that's in the heavenly courtroom who is Job's advocate, because God himself cannot find anything to accuse Job of. Here's what Gill says, quote, God, who dwells in the heavens where his throne is and which is the habitation of his holiness and from whence he beholds all the sons of men and their actions, is the all-seeing and all-knowing being. Well, that's nice, but as Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown point out, Job would then be asking God to be an advocate against himself. Remember, the contention is between God and Job. God's going to be the judge and Job's witness at the same time. Sort of mixes the metaphors a little bit. I prefer to take this as saying that Job's words are his witness in heaven, and his advocate is on high, meaning himself. I'm advocating my case before God. Certainly not his friends. Verse 20, they are scoffers. The NIV has here, my intercessor is my friend, which doesn't make a lot of sense to me. The NASB has, my friends are my scoffers, which makes sense to me. He's comparing his friends who are not advocating for him between, or comparing these friends with Job, who is advocating on high for Job. The NIV note there, the marginal note, translates it, my friends treat me with scorn, which is the way the NASB translates it. Verse 21, Job says, oh, that a man might plead with God as a man with his neighbor. In other words, if I'm pleading or arguing a legal case with a man, I could use great freedom in my arguments. I could use powerful arguments. I can't do that against God because he'll squish me like an ant. I'm afraid of God. He's the judge, and he's an awesome judge. But if I'm pleading with a man, no problem. The NIV translates this, on behalf of a man, he, referring to the intercessor, pleads with God, or the advocate, On behalf of a man, the advocate pleads with God as a man pleads for his friend. There's no conditional in the NIV translation, verse 21 in the NASB, oh, that a man might plead with God. If it were possible to plead with God as a man with his neighbor, I like that translation better. Job is feeling the terrible distance of God. God has abandoned him, he thought. He knows he's right. He knows he's just, but God's not there to back him up. Now, verse 21 has an interesting undertone. Oh, that a man might plead with God, Job says, as a son of man with his neighbor is the literal. Son of man. John Gill and Jameson Fawcett and Brown say that many take this to be a prefiguring of the advocacy of Christ in heaven as intercessor. Well, I believe that Jesus is an intercessor in heaven from the book of Hebrews, but I don't think we necessarily have to read it in here in the book of Job. Son of man just means a human being as a son of man with his neighbor. And of course, Daniel used that expression in Daniel 7, 13 and 14, and then Jesus took that expression, son of man, on himself to show that he was referring to himself as a Messiah. And so the term son of man came to have special meaning. But here in the time of Job, I don't think it has any special meaning. It just means as a man. And I don't think the translations will bring that out. So we go now to verse 22, Job 16, and we'll finish the chapter. Job finishes up and he says, for when a few years are past, I shall go the way of no return. Well, what's the way of no return? That's death. Because once you die, buddy, looking at it from this life, that's it. This verse probably should begin the next chapter. But we'll leave it here. We're now prepared to go to chapter 17, verses 1 through 16. We will entitle that chapter, Job Continues. Where then is my hope? More doom and gloom from the suffering Job. I hope you stay tuned for that audio so that you may commiserate with Job. And I hope you enjoyed this one.